Thanks, Kiko. Thanks, everybody, for sticking it out and listening to this whole session. We really appreciate the opportunity to talk about our certification. I think in public health, we can be really proud of health education and the process that we've done to have a really solid exam. It's been around for 26 years now and have gone through. This is actually the fourth time that we did a practice analysis. It started with the role delineation back in the 80s, and then we did the CUP, and then we did the HEDJA, and here we are now on the HESPA. And if you look around at other certifications that are available, you'll find that they haven't gone through that rigorous process. We also do have the accreditation from the NCCA, and now a new one, the ISO 17024 standard, which is international. So those of you in the beginning, as you were acknowledging that you had the certification, I hope you get a sense of what that means and how much work goes into that. I also want to acknowledge the folks that are here and also a whole cadre of volunteers who make this happen for you. The NCHEC staff is small. We have 7 staff in the office, and so all of the tasks that are required to do this are done on a volunteer basis. So my gratitude to those who are sitting at the table, those are the folks who are always there as I ask for, you know, help with particular tasks that we have to do, but those are also representative of a whole cadre of people who are putting this together for us. So thank you. Today I'm actually representing, I'm going to talk about the professional development part or the continuing ed part that's required of the certification. And I'm representing the Professional Development Board, and Nicolette Morin helped me to put together this presentation. My only relationship to disclose is I do work for NCHEC. It's a nonprofit, and so it's certainly, you know, there are some connections here. I want to make sure you saw that, but it's within the guidelines of APHA that I don't have anything that I have to disclose at this time. So I'll talk about the recertification, the requirements for maintaining the CHES and MCHES certification. I'll talk a little bit about the changes to the continuing education opportunities as a result of the recent HESPA, and that's really around the advanced level, the MCHES. And then I'll talk a little bit about ways to find continuing education opportunities that qualify towards the recertification requirements. And then I'm going to take a minute at the end to talk about a new concept, which is really coming forward in the certification world of continuing competence. So how do we measure that? Okay, one time we were competent, but as we move forward, how do we measure that? So in terms of recertification, there are requirements for the certification bodies to not just have a one-time certification, but what's the process by which you determine that the organization, by the credentialed individuals in your organization, have met a recertification requirement? It's not just once and done. And if the purpose of professional certification is to ensure a high level of competence within the health education workforce, then the maintenance of this competence is essential, and it's supported in our profession by continued training in the knowledge and methods of the field. So basically what that's saying is that we're not just trying to make your lives miserable by making you get 75 credits, but it's to represent something, that once you have that certification, that you continue that commitment to professional development. I know some employers will pay for that continuing education and some will not, but it really is a commitment in terms of expanding your knowledge and expanding your abilities as you move forward. So the requirements that have been established for the recertification are that over a period of 5 years you earn 75, we call them continuing education credit hours, or CECH. In some other professions they call them CEUs or continuing education units, but we call them continuing education credit hours. And of that 75, you can do it in combination. You can get your 75 credits all in category one, which means events that are offered by pre-approved providers. So they're pre-approved by NCHEC, either by the specific program that's being offered, or sometimes it's the providers themselves that are accredited. So here at APHA, APHA is a multiple event provider. The whole organization is a provider, and then they go through a process of approval. The same thing for SOFIA and American College Health and so on. So at least 45 of those 75 credits have to be by a pre-approved provider. if you wish, all 75 can come from a pre-approved provider. And the advantage is that those providers report those credits directly to NCHEC. So you go through the process to get those credits. Like here at APHA, you have to sign up in advance, and I understand that they charge you a fee. You have to fill out an evaluation. But then once that's done and they have the record of your attendance, they report that directly to NCHEC for you. To allow some flexibility, because some people we know are working in a specific topic area and they want to be able to earn credits in that area, certified individuals can get up to 30 of their credits in Category 2, meaning they self-report those credits. So if you have to go to a specific training for your job, you can put that in, and the responsibility then is on the individual, the certified individual, to link that professional development opportunity to one of the seven areas of responsibility. So that's for up to 30 can be done that way. Now that we've introduced the MCHES credential in 2011, those with the MCHES credential have to, either in Category 1 or Category 2, they have to get 30 of their credits need to be at the advanced level. So let me say that again to make sure there's not confusion. So this is different than Category 1 or Category 2, but those of us who hold the MCHES certification have to show that you have continuing ed in the advanced level, and this would be related to the advanced level subcompetencies. So again, a lot of the providers differentiate that and say that this session is available for advanced level credits. That's one way to do it. And what's unique about the MCHES as opposed to the CHES certification is that you can use some of your job-related activities for the advanced level credit. That is not true for the CHES. I see someone cheering in the background. So, for example, if part of your administrative duties within your job is to create a budget, that's actually something that you can get credit for and submit that. You don't submit the budget, you submit proof that you did the budget. I don't want to see your budget. But you can submit that as advanced level. So I think this is really important. I wanted to take a minute about that, because those of you who got the MCHES certification when it first came out and did it through the experience documentation opportunity, guess what? You'll be up for recertification in April 2016, so you need to have all your 75 credits, and you need to have 30 of those as advanced two, if you have it as advanced level, not advanced two, advanced one or two. But if you haven't already done that, there is hope, because you can do it for your job-related thing. You need to get a Category 2 claim form, stop by the booth, and look at that. You'll be surprised at some of the things that you can claim there. And because I know we have CHES in the room, I want to make sure that I explain that the rationale about that is CHES is considered entry level. So the idea is that we want those that are CHES certified to get the professional development opportunities, the continuing ed first. And then as you move into the MCHES, you can use some of your experience to claim your credits. So the HESPA, as we know, came up with seven areas of responsibility. These are what they look like. Notice that now we do have the word promotion in there. It's on each one of those. So, for example, Area 2, Plan Health Education / Promotion. And that was deliberately done to sort of broaden our horizons a little bit through the HESPA. So when you're submitting for entry level, it has to be in alignment with one of those seven areas of responsibility. The continuing education activities that are available for credit are available on the NCHEC website, and you can certainly go on the website and find those. And then here, I wanted to show you an example, because there was a time when it was hard to get the continuing ed, and people, you know, would say to us that they couldn't find them. But believe me, go for a trip on that website. There are a lot of opportunities there for you to get your continuing ed, and you can search them. So this may be a little hard for you to read, but you can search by topic, you can search by provider, you can search by the cost of the program. So if you're looking for free, you can put zero in there. If you want to make sure there's no additional CECH costs, you can put that in as zero as well if you're looking for advanced. So there's a lot of ways that you can put those in. And then you'll see that the programs come up. Oh, that's the slide I should have been showing you there, sorry. And you'll see that the series of programs come up that are available. So in this particular one, you can see the number of credits, whether they have advanced credits, the cost of those, if there's any cost for getting the credits themselves, like a processing fee. And these were particular events. And then the ones at the bottom were the self-studies. And there are certainly a lot of self-studies that are available free or very low cost. CDC has them, as well as the Center for Public Health Continuing Education. And I hear really good things about those online programs. So, and you can look at the bottom of the page, see all those additional, pages of these. There's just pages and pages of opportunities in there. And I think a lot of people just don't know to look there. So I would encourage you to do that. As a result of the HESPA, the Division Board for Professional Development went back and looked at the opportunities for the advanced level credits for Category 2, meaning self-report on advanced level. This is for MCHES only. And there's some new things that were validated that will be offered as the Category 2, again, only for the MCHES credential. And that would include develop a marketing plan, develop a logic model of evaluation, develop a strategic plan for your organization. These are all under leadership. Development of a policy analysis, that would be under Area 7, and conduct employee performance evaluations. You do have to give some kind of proof around this, and I would again make a statement of the proof would need to be some affirmation of what you did. I don't need to see the particular confidential information. I don't want to see anybody's performance evaluation. I just want to see affirmation that you did it. So I think that's helpful to know. There's one that used to be on there, which was conduct a gap analysis, which was actually removed because that wasn't validated within the study. And my last slide, I need to talk about a new development in the certification world, which is the whole concept of continuing competence. I've been serving on the ICE board, and this has been a hot topic. I'll tell you the pressure is coming from the outside of the certification world. There's a group called the Citizens Advocacy Center, and they have really been looking at certifications and competence within the certification world. It started in sort of medical providers, and it has expanded to all certifications. I'll be representing ICE at a conversation with the Citizens Advocacy Center next, it's in 2 weeks, it's in November, they're putting us on the hot seat a little bit in terms of the certification world of, okay, just because someone took the certification, and even if they took continuing education, how do you know that that person remains competent? So we've been looking at, some organizations are looking at really creative ways to do that. One of the leaders in this is actually the nurse anesthetist, and they've been looking at a self-reflection on competence that the individual certified person does, and then targets their continuing ed towards that. In other words, not the cheapest, fastest, easiest, but what do they really need to develop their own competence? And then they're looking at a recertification exam probably every 10 years. I'm not saying that we're doing that, I'm not saying that all certifications are doing that, but there's certainly conversations around what does the certification, what are the responsibilities of the certification body in terms of determining that their certified individual remains competent. Continuing competence programs are effective and well-recognized method of recertification, but they need to provide a meaningful and relevant process that demonstrates that the certificates remain current. Otherwise, the knowledge and skill determined at the time of initial certification would become outdated and therefore diminish the value of the certification to the public, employers, and certificates. Again, no decisions on this are made, but we certainly, as certification bodies, are getting pressure from outside groups to make sure that our certificates remain competent. So just put that out there as a little teaser for you so that you know what, you know, could potentially be coming forward in the future. And that there is an Institute of Medicine report that's looked at this issue as well. And on that, I'd say stay tuned. Don't panic yet, but I just wanted to let you know that there are conversations going on about that. So, Kiko, I'll turn it back over to you. That's the end of my presentation, and there might be some questions for any of us.
Thank you so much.
Before we turn it over for questions, I mentioned that we had a 10-member task force and that you might know some of those people. Well, one is in the room. Grace Smith came in, and so if you don't know one of the members, here's a chance right now to get to know her. Thank you, Grace, for being here.
Thank you very much. And now we have, you know, a little more time to be, you know, for the questions. Anybody has any questions for the presenter? Yes.
Thanks for that question. So yeah, that's exactly right. So in your job, you're working in tobacco, you need a particular, you know, training, and that certainly would be along the lines of the health education areas of responsibility. It's probably going to be under planning and implementation. So as long as you're able to give us, you would submit proof that you attended, you would submit something about, you know, the learning objectives, what this program was, you know, and then just link it for us. You know, this is area one, this is area two, whatever it is, and let us know. But that sounds very good. The other thing I would say is sometimes when you go to those kinds of programs, you might be able to encourage those organizations to become designated providers. It's really not a difficult process, especially for a particular event like that. And so you could refer them to the NCHEC website. You could even offer to be the CHES on their planning committee. That would help them to link it to the areas of responsibility and help them in the process, because then you could get category one for that. So does that answer your question? Okay. Perfect. Those forms are on our website. You can also stop by our booth and get them.
All right, great. And then, even though I'm asking it now, is this something that, say, from training that I did before, can you backdate those, or how does that work?
So technically, I think the form says within 90 days, but we really are lenient about that. And if it has to be within your recertification cycle. So whenever your 5-year, you know, switched over, it has to be within there. But, you know, we're not going to penalize people. As long as you can get the proof, you know, we're going to work with you. Again, we're trying to hold people to standards, but we're not trying to make it difficult. We're just trying to have competence.
And then my other question would be, so going from the CHES state to the
NCHES. Okay. Okay, so eligibility for the MCHES, there's a couple of ways, and one is if you have been CHES certified and you're active for 5 years, you're automatically eligible to sit for the MCHES exam. So in order to be MCHES at this point now, you always have to take the exam, but so someone who's CHES, even with a bachelor's degree, but 5 years active as a CHES, can sit for that MCHES exam. If someone has not been CHES certified for 5 years, then they would need to have a master's degree in health education or the 25 credits in health education, and then show 5 years experience in health education. So even if you, I think it sounded like you had a job change in there for a while, you weren't doing health education, but as long as you can show within a reasonable period of time that you had 5 years of experience, that would be okay too. Okay? Okay. What else?
Yes.
Hi, Kim. Is this for me or somebody else?
This is for
Linda first. Hey, how come I'm getting all the questions? There's more than people here.
I think all of you might be able to, yeah, to answer this question. So I'm looking at the, so now we have the HESPA,
yep,
prominence. How then, or not, I don't say how, but is this going to, or how is it going to impact ASPPH, possibly, when we start looking at some of their, they don't have a set type of competencies yet that we have for our MPH program, but how does it impact some of those, whether we're going from the old, I think it was 2006, so 2013, I don't remember, the MPH and the BRPH competencies around
behavioral health science, but how is, do you have any information? I say this because my program, we're actually currently doing what Carrie is talking about, and mapping the MPH program, and I'm going heavily on my experience using the HEDA model at the time. So, with my colleagues, so I'm really interested in what you think about. Carrie, that might be a question for you.
Well, with our MPH program at Virginia Tech, we have a public health education track. So a lot of the competencies are really going to be addressed in that track and the practicum and capstone that's associated with that. Probably a good half the program. And then other competencies would be picked up in epidemiology or the health behavior courses, the core to the MPH. So the MPH itself, just without a public health education track or something similar to that, it'd be tough to map it to HESPA in a way totally. I mean, I don't know what 60% of it may map well, but there's still going to be that 40% that's purely health education that's not going to necessarily map well unless you have a health education track as a part of the MPH program. So, yeah, again, there's going to be some similarities, but the cleaner the mapping would be is if you have a health education track in the MPH program, then it's going to be a very good mapping process, a very clean one.
Okay, thanks. And then the second question for Linda is, for those of us that are going up for intensive therapy and able like myself, does the current Category 2 form, has it been updated now?
No, that won't happen until after April, so we're still working on, you know, the current. Come talk to me though, because it's amazing that things that you're doing really fit in with those Category 2, and people don't realize it. So just, I think you have to sit down with the forum and talk about it, you know, a little bit. The other thing I wanted to say regarding the CEF accreditation is that there is something within that accreditation which says that you need to map your program, whatever it is, to the competencies of the profession. So while they have the, right now they have the five core areas of public health, you still, if you're calling it a health education program, you still have to map it to the.
The question though that I'm finding is that CEF is saying yes, you can use those five areas, but in those cross cutting areas, mm-hmm. but then they're also just talk about using the counseling of things. And when I called them, they said, well, we really don't prescribe a specific set of
competencies
that we have to follow.
Right.
But, you know, I'm dealing with people who want to try and meld.
I gotcha. And if you've looked at the new, you know, CEF has out proposed revisions to their accreditation standards, and those actually, to me, moved away from the five core areas of public health, and they have allowed a lot more, the language there looks a lot more like our language, in my opinion. So, you know, one of the things of certification organizations and accreditation transportation organizations is that we always have to keep updating our competencies and updating, you know, the requirements. And so I know for you all, it kind of makes a little bit of a moving target. But if bringing it back to the HESPA, the changes are minimal, really. I mean, a lot of there, you know, we've reclassified some, but they're basically the same. There's some new in advocacy. There's some more in the evaluation. It's more heavily in advanced too. But, you know, basically the other one was social media. There's some more about social media, but there's not a whole lot of movement in terms of things that we once had that, you know, are no longer current. That would be my take on it. Anything else? Oh, there's somebody in the back. Can I get that person? Because you haven't had an opportunity.
I'm not a certified health educator, so I don't, it doesn't affect me personally whether or not people are required to take health education exam with the faculty. But just from an adult learning perspective, I wanted to mention that I think it affords more rigor and more validity if the certifying board updates the competencies and keeps in touch with the health educators and asks them to provide practice-based evidence of touching those competencies to work either by formal training or informal training or practice-based things in their mind. And I think that actually lends itself to more validity and more rigor. And I think that it's fair to the diversity of the workforce that you have. Not everybody wants to have an academic bent, and I think that the text lends itself to validity around academic skills and not necessarily around health education. So I would just suggest that just from someone who's not a person in health education.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that comment. And I think that comments like that have gone into the whole idea of continuing competency and how you would look at that. Thank you.
I will say, though, that when we have representatives from all different health education backgrounds, not just university faculty, we have people that work in health departments, people that work in schools, they're all writing questions with us, so we try to really represent the entire field.
Yes, but what I mean is the act of a professional needing to demonstrate to an exam is an academic activity. And some may be very good at health education and may not fare well, and may not be true to whether or not they deserve to do that.
Thank you.
I would also say that there are a lot of people who home health education can, but there is a distinction between a professionally trained health educator. And to be honest, the advocacy of my profession as a health educator, I really do want somebody who's eligible to get to the exam and have that formal training to just someone who's like, you know, the spoken to patients. Okay. I bet a lot of postal workers and nurses who talk about an health educator. I don't know, you're a nurse, you're a postal worker. You may perform some of those tests, but I'm a health educator, I'm trained. And that training is cross-training. So education is a public health. So not just the act of
I appreciate the comment about sort of the professional training and the eligibility for the exam, and we didn't mention this, but that actually is part of what we're required to do in the certification and in the HESPA to, you know, once the job analysis is done, is to do a reaffirmation that the eligibility requirements, you know, remain valid after looking at that study. So we did do that, and I neglected to say that, so thanks for that comment. It was a reminder. I think there was one more question over here.
For Diane, doing the development of the questions for the exam, has there been any thought in doing, say, maybe besides having a completely multiple choice, if there's like opportunity for essay writing, is there opportunity to maybe develop logic models for the test? Because I'm questions, they're not easy questions, they're challenging. They do challenge you during that time to really think about it and go back to, you know, what exactly your work is and how you can apply the situation to everyday real life. But sometimes maybe even through the form of essay writing, you can get more of that information across where you can show, I have developed a skill set, I know what I need to do, how I should be able to perform, you know, as a health educator with the passion for my job, not just doing it as a job.
My only comment on that, we haven't discussed that, and I think it's because we all are volunteers. And it's difficult to even get away from your job to come in on a Thursday to start working on, you know, Friday and weekends. And I can't imagine reading 800 essays, and who's going to do that? And without compensation or for the time that it would take to do that, and there would have to be a whole way to develop standards for grading those. So I just think that is not where we are. What we are looking to is computer-based testing, so that it's less difficult as far as many, you know, people taking it paper and pencil. And I think, you know, that's something that we'll see in the future.
Any more questions?
One more.
Yes.
Talking about, actually, I mentioned the MLS on October 17th.
Ooh, you're waiting.
Okay, so there's a lot of considerations that go into that. It is on the radar of our Board of Commissioners. They put that into the strategic plan, that at least evaluate the possibility of moving to computer-based testing. I'll tell you that there are many reasons to do it, such as convenience. Hopefully, eventually, you could get your score more quickly. It might allow us to do things internationally, you know, not just, it's hard to offer it paper pencil exam, you know, in other places. So in terms of even perception of a paper and pencil exam might be seen as sort of a little bit outdated. Yeah. But when I talk to the testing companies about that, they say that it's not necessarily outdated and there's a lot of certification organizations that remain doing that. The costs change and the cost of the candidate may go up, and that's where our board might have a little problem about that, because right now there are economies that are made, you know, if there are more people testing at one test site. But when you start doing computer-based testing, those costs are per candidate. So every time a candidate sits, you know, for the exam, it's this amount of money. And for every candidate, as opposed to if you have 20 people in the room, it's, you know, a more shared cost. So that's one of the concerns that our board has in terms of being well aware that, you know, the exam costs are a critical part of the decision. So that's one thing. Another has to do with the amount of questions you have to have in the test bank if you're going to go to a truly computer-based testing. And so we've been working on that, ramping up the number of questions that we have available, but that goes into it as well. We've been talking to the testing companies about that. They think that this is a viable thing for us, but we have not, I need to be really clear, we have not yet made a board decision to move to computer-based testing, only to evaluate it. So we'll see. Within the next couple years, we should have a decision on that. But yeah.
Anybody else?
They have more for me, but it's okay.
Right, so thank you for all for your time.